I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January 30th, 2015. The time is 3:31 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Stoltz, Senator Coghill, Senator Welikowski, and myself, Senator Giesel. Excused absences today are Senator Machicki and Senator Stedman. Recording Secretary, we have Ann today with us, and helping us out with the audio is Thatcher. Thank you very much to Ann and Thatcher. Well, it's been a year, almost a year, since we sat here and deliberated Senate Bill 138, passing it into law. So today we're going to get an update on the Alaska LNG project, otherwise known to Alaskans as the Big Pipeline, as part of the requirements of Senate Bill 138. This review will focus on how the integrated project is progressing on facility and infrastructure design work, while securing permits required to ensure the project is successful and ready to evaluate the FEED decision, that's front-end engineering and design, in 2016. Currently, we're in pre-FEED. This review represents joint work by all the parties involved in the project, including the state through AGDC and TransCanada, BP, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon. The integrated project work is separate from the work that the individual parties are completing on related issues defined under Senate Bill 138, those issues being property tax, royalty structures, and fiscal issues, including durability. These separate issues will be the subject of subsequent updates this committee will hear within the next 3 weeks. We look forward to that phase of updates with the appropriate representatives of all of the parties, as well as the point persons from the Department of Revenue, as well as the Department of Natural Resources, to ensure that the legislature and the public are fully informed on the path forward. So today I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Steve Butt, Project Manager for AKLNG, who I understand you're a Colts fan and they're not playing on Sunday.
That's true.
But there's something about Stanford, possibly next season.
Maybe.
I don't know. I don't know much about this. I just hear these words.
They played well at the last couple games.
Oh, Madam Chair, is this an invitation for daily sports?
Not from me. Not from me.
Okay. As Vice Chair, I object to the...
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Costello.
Issues. I can add some dialogue.
Through the chair,
thank you.
Senator Stoltz, I promise not to be like Marshawn Lynch. I'm happy to be here. I'll answer all questions.
A sense of humor.
Great. One thing we always ask, Mr. Butt, is that acronyms be defined as folks are listening into the meeting. So welcome.
Thank you for the kind invitation, Chairperson Giesel. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I always like to have the opportunity to talk about the project. I know different folks have different levels of awareness, so I would invite questions along the way and as much of a discussion environment as possible to make sure I'm answering your questions and make sure we're using this time well. It's a real privilege to be here and provide this update consistent with the request of SB 138. So I'd just like to start by saying I'm here on behalf of the Alaska LNG project, but that means I'm really just talking about the work that's been done by hundreds of people. There's about 130 people from all the different companies involved in the Alaska LNG project, and those companies include the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, AGDC, BP, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and TransCanada. That leadership team leads several hundred contractors to create the Alaska LNG project. And what we're doing now is what we call pre-FEED, and I'll talk about how that all fits and try and talk about the path forward from pre-FEED a little bit. But my privilege to be here is to represent the good work all those people are doing. So I am talking about the work done by the project, and the project is created under a set of agreements by those companies to do shared work to see if we can create an infrastructure to transport, treat, and liquefy gas here in Alaska in a competitive manner. We do that and create these shared teams because we think it helps drive down costs. Our objective is shared. Create an infrastructure, create an LNG project that can compete globally. Now, there are other issues that the owners work in different forums. There's another 100 plus people working what we call owner issues, commercial issues, framework issues with the state, places where different owners have different views, which are kind of outside this review that I'm going to give you. They're still part of the Alaska LNG project. They are essential to moving the project forward, so I consider them part of the project. But they're issues that are owned by different groups of people representing the different owner entities. And when I talk about the owner entities, I mean the state of Alaska, BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil. And I'll talk a little bit more about that because it's a fundamental issue. And those issues are separate. And I think that was clear in your kind introduction. And I'm happy to facilitate bringing any of those people to the Senate Resource Commission at your convenience to answer any questions. And if you can help us understand what you'd like to talk about, I'll make sure we get the right people here. I'll help you make sure we get the right people here and work with the different owners.
Excuse me, Mr. Butt. So you're talking about, you know, all the teams that you're bringing together, all the folks working on this. Have you ever been involved in a project like this before? And if so, where? What was the size of that? How did it work out? What's your experience with this kind of thing?
Okay, Senator Giesel, I don't think anyone has ever been involved in a project of this magnitude before because there hasn't been one. One of the things that's unique about this project is the size and scope. It's $45 to $65 billion. It's in some ways measured as five mega projects. Mega projects are often defined as anything over $1 to $10 billion. Each of the elements of this project exceed that. So each of these projects is in and of themselves a mega project. There are a couple very close parallels that myself and others on the team have been involved in. In Venezuela, we built large field treating plants connected with large pipelines to the coast where there were large treating facilities for export. Those are pretty close. They weren't this big. They didn't cost this much money, but I do have that experience. We also have experience in other parts of the world with liquefaction where we've built large treating facilities to remove impurities, 400 miles of pipe to liquefaction facilities for export. So there are parallels, but nothing of this scope. And we can draw on all those parallels because the owner organizations we have experience across all that. I always like to talk about in different pages the different characteristics of the organization. I like to say that our 130-person team has, you know, well over a couple thousand years of experience. But our leadership team, which is the 27 top jobs in managerial and leadership roles, we have over 800 years of experience. We have in excess of 300 million metric tons of LNG design experience. Now, to put that into context, the whole world only consumes 250 million metric tons of LNG. One of our engineering managers has individually designed and built almost 80 million metric tons of LNG. Our LNG plant manager has personally been involved in excess of 30 million metric tons of LNG. So we have a lot of experience doing this. We've done each of the pieces of this project somewhere. There is a gas plant as large as this one, which I had the privilege to work with in the Middle East. I was the general manager of the project. There are pipelines that are as big as this, which we have representatives from TransCanada and other team members working in an integrated manner where they've built pipelines like this. And there are bigger LNG plants than this, but nobody's ever put all three together. Nobody's ever put all three together in Alaska. Nobody's ever put all three together in Alaska and permitted it in the United States, and nobody's ever done it in this environment. So, you know, I think that's a great question. I think we have a lot of relevant experience, but I don't think anybody actually has that experience, and the fact that nobody has the exact experience we need shapes everything we do as we work with contractors. We're always trying to marry up what we call global LNG experience with local Alaskan experience so we get the right mix and get the folks who could do the job properly. But, you know, to talk a little bit about where I'm going to go, I'm not going to talk a lot about the design of the project. I know some of you have been involved in these reviews many, many times, and I would avoid Groundhog Day. But I would really ask that if I don't answer something from previous reviews and you'd like to talk about it, I'm happy to do that. I'm just out of respect for time and the fact. I'm not going to go into how the project is designed and the concept work. I'm just going to headline it by saying it's $45 to $65 billion, three fundamental elements, treat the gas, which means we remove the impurities, put them back in the ground, transport the gas, which means we move it from the North Slope, from the resource fields at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, where we liquefy the gas, which is where we make the gas very, very cold, minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit. It shrinks from the volume of a gas to the volume of a liquid by a factor of 600, which means we can ship a given volume of gas with one carrier instead of 600 carriers. That's why we do it. It's always important, and any time we have an opportunity to talk about the LNG business, to remind everybody that LNG is just a commodity. It's just gas. The first thing the people who buy it do with it is they warm it back up. They take it from a liquid state and they return it to a gaseous state, and they use that gas for utilities or home heating or all the other benefits that we enjoy here. But that makes it a commodity, and in the commodity business, low cost wins because they're always trying to source that commodity at the lowest cost possible. So those frameworks are important.
Excuse me, Steve. Senator Stoltz had a question.
Senator Giesel, not on the specific presentation, but I'm several hundred hours behind in participation in these hearings from you over the years, last few. I just didn't remember, and if I didn't hear it, maybe the public didn't. Again, Mr. Butt, the representation just in the notes, it just says Alaska LNG. Just to clarify who the presentation is from, state, industry, and I apologize for my lack of awareness, but if I am, the public is probably not as attuned as well if I'm not.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, thank you for the good question. Alaska LNG is a joint venture organization formed under a joint venture agreement that was signed in the middle of 2014. The parties to that agreement are...
I understand that part, but who you're representing today and what from where you come.
Okay. I represent those entities who all were involved in developing this material as the senior project manager for the group. And I talk about all the project issues that are shared by all the parties. That doesn't mean I talk about the owner issues and the different commercial frameworks where the owners have different views. I'm here to talk about how the project works and how it moves. In the project context, we are designing the facilities required to build the project, the regulatory work that's required to permit the project, and all the cost and schedule work that's required to support moving from a pre-FEED decision to a FEED decision, and I have a page on that to talk about what that means. But that's a group of people that are kind of figuring out how we would design and build this thing.
Where are you fed and watered? I mean, where you get your pay? And that's what I'm...
No.
It's causing me some... again, I apologize, my lack of awareness, but it just says Alaska LNG.
Through the chair, Senator Stoltz, I bill my time back to the entities. So my time is paid for as a function of the participating interests by all of them. The whole 130 people are billed in the same manner.
I'm sorry if I was behind the curve.
That's great.
I'm happy to talk about my background if you'd like.
I think you covered
your... If he's sitting here, just by the caliber of folks we've had presented, I don't need to see your curriculum vitae. The fact that you're sitting here gives me a lot of, because I've seen the quality of people that we have employed in this project.
Yeah. The strength of the project is really good, and the quality of the people is excellent, and I'm privileged to work amongst them and speak on their behalf. But that's really all I'm doing. I'm speaking on their behalf. But I bill my time to the parties, and the whole project team bills their times to the parties, which is a great way to differentiate the people who work the owners' issues. They don't bill their time to the parties. They bill their time to individual owners, and they represent different views. So there's places where I'm very comfortable answering your questions, and then there's places on owners' issues where I probably won't. But I'll always do my very best to differentiate them, and if you want to follow up on any owners' issue, I'll help facilitate getting the right people, and I'm confident that anybody this committee invites to address it will be happy to come.
And for clarification, again, as I said when we opened, we'll have the individual parties here, the top people, individually in about 3 weeks. And so this is one aspect of a sequence of hearings that will fulfill the statutory requirement of Senate Bill 138. So today is just one of a series of meetings.
I'm much caught up, Madam Chair.
All right, great. Go ahead, please, Mr. Butt.
I appreciate the questions and look forward to more. So the only other thing I would say is, in addition to the size of the project, I always think it's important to talk about some of the benefits the project generates. In earlier presentations, we always talk about the job creation for building a project of this size is somewhere on the order of 10,000 to 15,000 jobs for construction and somewhere on the order of 1,000 jobs for the operating phase. Construction phases last several years. The operating phase lasts decades. Permitting, engineering, all the work we're doing now, we have in excess of 1,000 people working it through all the different owner organizations, the project organizations, and the contract organizations that are helping us do the work. So the benefits are high levels of job creation, and there's been some great work that's been done through state representatives, Analytica, Black & Veatch, to look at how that all works. With that said, I was just going to really focus on what we've accomplished since the last time we had the opportunity to provide this committee an update in September of 2014. We have an opportunity to provide three updates a year under SB 138, so this is our first one for 2015, about 4 months after we did our last one in September of 2014. Since that time, we haven't had any safety, health, or environmental incidents to report. We spend a lot of our time in the safety, health, and environment front building what we call a culture of caring. It's really important to us that we're in very early stages of a project here that we hope will grow and become much larger, involving thousands and thousands of people. And in doing so, we really want to have a framework that everybody understands they have an individual role to help each other to go home safely. It sounds like a simple task, but it's very complex, and it's about being present. It's about making sure that when people make decisions and do work, they're present. They're thinking about, what am I doing right here and now, and they're not thinking about other things, because that's what creates a safe work environment. And we create that environment by making sure we reinforce caring for each other, that we want each other to be present, focus on what we're doing, execute it safely, and then be able to go home safely.
Excuse me, Mr. Butt. Senator Costello had a question.
Thank you, and through the chair. Steve, my question is about the jobs that you had mentioned earlier. Do we know specifically what types of jobs? Because I'm very concerned about our ability to prepare kids who are really in third, fourth grade today for the jobs that might exist for them if this project goes through. And just was curious, when you throw that number out, 10,000 to 15,000 for the first phase, how specific can we get in terms of what types of jobs, what skills we have to be looking to train our young people for?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, we can characterize where the work is. We can characterize the type of skills requisite, but we're at an early stage of definition. I think the next slide will do a really good job of talking about how project design works, where we move from pre-feed to feed. I like to use the analogy of a house. If you're building a house, you start by deciding where do you want to put it, on a hillside, by a lake, by a river. How big is it? Where do you want things to look? That's kind of concept framing, but it's very high-level stuff. And that concept work is done on this project. In a home, after you kind of decide where you want everything to go, you decide how big are the rooms, how tall is the ceiling, what's the roof look like, things like that that really help you frame the structure, help you get an idea of what it's going to cost. That's what we would consider a parallel to pre-feed. Feed, a parallel would be you really get specific. How big are the studs, and what kind of foundation is it, and where are you going to source the concrete, and where are you going to get the screws, and where are you going to get the nails, and how are you going to move the trucks around to provide that? And you get very, very detailed, such that you understand every single thing you can to remove all risk, and that's feed. And at that feed stage is where you have great clarity on every single job you need. Right now we can characterize the type of work we need, the scope of the work, but we're a little early to have like a list of here's all the jobs we need. We know the framework of it, and because we have a lot of folks who have some experience doing this, we know the agreements and structures we need to put into place to do that, but it's a little early to say, here's jobs 1 through 10,000.
Follow-up?
Yes, follow-up, Senator Casilla.
And thank you for that response through the chair. And who will be deciding or helping identify what those jobs are? Does the Workforce Investment Board deal? I mean, does the state have a role, or is it simply the project itself that will then be communicating to the legislature information at that level, and that's specificity?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, once we kind of have a feed design and we understand what we need, we can be working with the different state agencies like the Department of Labor and others on how we do that. But earlier on, we'll work on training centers and enabling mechanisms to make sure we get as much of the right resources as possible. You kind of do that as you move into feed and get a sense of where you need those fits. One of the early elements of pre-feed is labor studies on what's available. So you engage with all the state agencies. You also engage with federal agencies. We also engage with the broader market. Who's building what where? I can't stress enough that the LNG business is very competitive in terms of being able to supply the gas, but it's also very competitive in terms of getting the right skills and getting the right people, because there's a lot of work out there. There's a lot of projects out there, and I'll make a couple comments about that, but you want to be able to make sure you get the right resources in the right place. So,
thank you.
Senator Costello, of course, is the chairperson of the Labor and Commerce Committee, so this is a top issue for her. I also want to thank Commissioner Designee Mark Meyer and Deputy Commissioner Marty Rutherford for joining us today. Welcome. I'll let you go ahead.
So if I could, there's a couple things that we've accomplished at a real high level. We call it our executive summary. And then I'll run through a little bit more detail. So I'm going to hit these in very cursory order, and then we'll spend a little bit more time on all the elements. I'll take a 1 minute to look at the right half of the page and talk about how the project is built and just suggest the right half of this page is a picture of the project. We have the resources at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson that provide the gas. It's about 35 trillion cubic feet of gas. That gas is piped into a treatment plant, which is proximal to the central gas facility at Prudhoe Bay. That gas treatment plant removes the impurities. It takes the CO2 out. Prudhoe Bay has about 11% CO2. We need to remove all that. It's about 450 million cubic feet of CO2 a day. It's about 4.5 trillion cubic feet of CO2 over the life. We just take it out of the gas, and we put it back in the ground. The reason we take it out of the gas is CO2 is a different fluid. It behaves in a liquid phase at sometimes, it behaves in a gaseous phase at sometimes, and it freezes at a relatively low temperature. So if our objective is to take methane gas and move it from 30 degrees Fahrenheit to minus 260 Fahrenheit, anything that's in that gas that isn't methane freezes early and creates a lot of problems. So we have to take it out, and the way we take it out is through a treatment facility, and I'll show you some pictures on how we do that. Once the gas has been cleaned up and treated, it goes into a pipeline. It's the red line that you see moving from Prudhoe Bay down into the Cook Inlet area. It's about 800 miles long, where there's an LNG plant that we propose putting in the Nikiski industrial area. We can talk a little bit more about that as we move into that page, but what the fundamental purpose of that plant is to make it cold, make the gas shrink, make the volume shrink by a factor of 600, so we move one ship instead of 600 ships. We do that through compression cycles. We compress the gas, we release the pressure. If you think about a camp stove, when you open the needle on a camp stove, you can feel it gets cold. It's because you're releasing the pressure. If you have a very big pressure cylinder and you're creating pressure, you can feel it get hot. What we do is we use compression cycles to separate those two things, make the gas cold over time through many, many cycles and very, very large compressors. It allows us to take the volume of gas and make it very, very cold. That's our objective. To that end, we have spent about $82 million on pre-FEED since the middle of 2014. To Senator Stoltz's question, those monies are carried by the participating partners of the joint venture agreement. The state of Alaska, through SB 138, has a 25% participating equity interest in the project. They have two agents that represent them. The first is TransCanada, which represents the state in the midstream elements, and the midstream elements are the pipeline and the gas treatment plant, which means TransCanada is paying the state share of all work for the gas treatment plant and the pipeline. So the state's 25% in the midstream is carried and paid for by TransCanada, and the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation carries the state's participating interest and those costs in the downstream. The other elements are paid for by the other joint venture participants, consistent with their equity interests. Right now, we're continuing to ramp up our spend. We're at about $25 to $30 million a month, and that's the spend we think we'll be able to execute over the next several months, and I'll show you a little bit more on the next page, where we'll get through pre-FEED and we'll get the work done. One of the reasons I have confidence the pre-FEED work will get done is all the contracting is done, all the companies are in place. We have very large global LNG companies involved. We have Chiyoda and CB&I working together on the LNG plant. We have URS, CB&I working on the GTP. At both the LNG plant and the LNG plant, we also have the ASRC, the Arctic Slope Resource Corporation, the Energy Services arm, or AES, or ASRC Energy Services, is representative. So it's a great example where we have global LNG players with a local Alaskan corporation from day one in the design at both of the plants. In the pipeline, we have a little bit more streamlined group where we have a smaller group of people doing pipeline design work with a company called Worley Parsons, who has a long history of doing the design work previously through other companies. I'll show you a little bit more on that. But We have these large contracting companies in place. We have these teams in place. We have all the structures in place, and they've met their 30-day deliverables. We finished our contracting objectives in October of 2014 as expected, so that's happened subsequent to our last review, and the work is going well. We've also got a lot of confidence that we'll be able to get the first 12 resource reports done early in the next month. We're pretty comfortable with that. We submitted the first and 10th late last year. We have 2 through 9 and 11 and 12 largely complete. We hope to start pushing them over to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, who is the umbrella organization that administers the Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS. This is it's very important because these resource reports enable us to complete an environmental impact statement, and the environmental impact statement underpins a construction permit. We can't build the project until we get the permit. We can't get the permit until we finish an environmental impact statement that demonstrates we aren't going to adversely impact the environment. These resource reports are the mechanism we use to make that demonstration. So our progress on them is fundamental. It's one of the most important things we do. We kind of think that our focus right now is de-risking cost and schedule and finishing the regulatory and permitting work. So we've made some really good progress on that.
Steve? Pause on these resource reports. My understanding is these reports are the opportunity for Alaskans, the general public, to comment, to review them and offer input, particularly the report number 5, which addresses socioeconomic issues. True? What am I missing there? Anything else?
Senator Giesel, that is correct.
Okay.
I would just, however, suggest they are one of many mechanisms. And I'll show you some material later on the FERC process and the resource reports that show opportunities for engagement. FERC has open houses where we open to the public. They can come directly, and I'll show you all that.
Great.
But the resource reports are just one of many mechanisms that engage all the stakeholders, including the Alaskans, in the process. And to your point, Resource Report 5 is a socioeconomic report, but the first draft, which is what we're completing, is a framework. We then work with the stakeholders to complete it. The framework is written in pencil. We work with the stakeholders, Alaskans and others, to complete it in pen, and that's the second report, and I'll show you that on the next page.
Thank you.
To your point, I'll jump. Well, one other thing we've accomplished that we're really proud of is the Department of Energy, or the DOE, has provided an export authorization to the project to all free trade nations. That was received in early November. That allows us to export LNG to the country where we have free trade agreements. Now, that's only a portion of the market, and our original application solicited both free trade and non-free trade country access. The reason is simple. We want to be able to sell LNG to anybody that wants to buy it because we want to have the most competitive environment for buyers, just like we have the most competitive environment as sellers. We need that to work both ways. So we've been working very closely with the Department of Energy. They have been excellent to work with. They have made a lot of time. They're working this very hard. But in between when they provide the FTA agreement and the non-FTA agreement, it's kind of a quiet period while they do their work. So they're just continuing to work it. But we have every confidence that they're working it, and we're very grateful for all the time they've done. As I mentioned earlier, in addition to the resource reports, probably the best way for the public to get involved is through the open house sessions with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission participation. We have a great socioeconomic team with members from all the participating companies. They've led somewhere on the order of 65 to 75 community open house sessions all over the state. 14 of those have been attended by FERC. But what happens is when we submit the first draft resource reports, is FERC kind of takes the reins on the open houses. Instead of the project administering them and doing the invitations and leading the conversations, FERC does that. And the reason for that is to make sure that all the community members and all the stakeholders have unfettered access to FERC, and they feel like they can say whatever's on their mind, that they have a clean, open way to talk. And now, if I could, I'd like to kind of transition from that and talk a little bit about confidentiality and transparency. This is a fundamental mechanism to help Alaskans feel like they have enough transparency to feel comfortable with this project. I think the new administration has done a great job helping all of us understand the importance of transparency, because as we go forward, we'll talk about how big this investment's going to be and what it means to Alaska as an owner. We really have to have transparency so that folks feel like their share of that investment makes sense. This is a fundamental way to make that happen. Now, the flip side of that is sometimes talked about in terms of confidentiality. And I didn't want to, you know, leave this discussion without taking a minute on confidentiality because it's so important, and I know it's a topic that's worth talking about. We think of confidentiality in a competitive context. The LNG business has about two projects pursuing every one LNG molecule, which means from a supply side, there's twice as much capacity being designed and pursuing regulatory permits as the market thinks it needs. Now, it's not exactly 2-to-1 on the number of projects, but it's 2-to-1 on the volume. And this is a very big project. So for this project to move forward, it's going to displace more than one project. But for simplicity, we can use the ratio of 2-to-1 in terms of a competitive environment. Given that very, very competitive framework, we think it's important that we keep the information that preserves our competitiveness a little bit confidential. That doesn't mean we should in any way exclude anybody, and it means we have to be a lot more thoughtful about how we have transparent information to a broad range of people, but we want to do that in a way that doesn't compromise our competitiveness. Some of the design work we do, we would be uncomfortable putting in the public domain because there's a lot of competition in places around the world, Western Canada, Eastern Africa, the Gulf of Mexico. The project team and the project participants, the owner entities, we feel like we're pretty good at this. We're not really interested in helping others compete with us. We think that the state as an owner equity shares that. So what we have to do is find the right way to balance that transparency so that as people move forward and have to spend more, they feel comfortable that it makes sense.
Madam Chair.
Yes, I'm sorry, Senator Coghill.
I didn't want to interrupt that, so complete that thought, and then I want to move back up to the free trade.
Okay. So to complete the thought, our challenge is how do we preserve a competitive environment? How do we preserve our competition, our competitiveness, while being as transparent as possible and sharing as much information as we can? That's a challenge. And since I can't look over my shoulder, I think the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources and the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources are back there, and I've really appreciated getting to know them over the last few weeks, and we've had some great conversations about this topic, and the Deputy Commissioner did an excellent job of challenging all the sponsors to find a way to meet this challenge. How are we going to be more transparent and build awareness in a manner that doesn't compromise our competitiveness? And I can tell you that all the sponsoring groups, all the entities that were there, share that vision and are ready to do that. We're not quite sure how we're going to do that, but we want to do that. To kind of illustrate the point a little, I want to share just a little anecdote with everybody. Sometimes when I'm here talking with different folks, I have great opportunities to talk to different groups, and I had a chance to talk with some business leaders a couple weeks ago about confidentiality, and I asked them, you know, how are we going to do this? How are we going to help Alaskans feel comfortable that there's enough transparency here that there's going to be a little bit more trust? You know, skepticism is our greatest challenge, and we need to build some trust to get past it. How are we going to do that? And one of the business leaders had the best answer of all. He said, I think everybody's bid should be in the public domain except mine. And he was, tongue-in-cheek, but he hit it right on the head. We all share a desire to be as transparent as possible, but we don't want to compromise competitiveness. And that's going to be our challenge. We're just going to have to work together on that. But we all agree on it, and we all know it's something we have to do better on. And one great step towards transparency are FERC-led community open houses where people can say whatever's on their mind to the FERC representatives about the project. And that's a great first step. Building on that is the 2015 summer field season where we gather all the data for regulatory permits. And I'll show you some slides on that. But I'm going to stop and let you go back to the FTA.
Senator Coghill. Yeah.
I think for those Alaskans and for me, too, it's not just competitive amongst those companies who may bid on this project, but it's competition that we have for who could supply to the customers. So the FTA or the free trade agreements talks about who could be our customers at this point. And I know the governor went to China, to Ban as well as China. And the way I understand it, Japan is not part of the free trade agreement, but your desire was, at this point, as a project, to be able to sell to them at your first application, if I remember correctly. Yeah. So help me understand. It looks like Asia-Pacific is our shipping advantage, because if we can come off Alaska, Asia-Pacific seems to be the best direct route. Who else besides Japan, and that's what I heard, was Japan is not a free trade agreement yet, and yet is probably one of our best working customers, probably has been for a good long while. Who else?
Okay, through the chair, Senator Coghill. I really can't talk about marketing strategies because of anti-competitive reasons, but what I can tell you is the owners who created the commercial framework to secure the export permits and the authorizations for both FTA and non-FTA countries pursue both to make sure we have the broadest market of all. That gives us the broadest range of competition as a seller. So you are correct that Japan is a non-FTA country, so we have to get that subsequent authorization to have Japan be a customer. That's just simply a fact. I'm happy to share that. FTA countries are like Korea, and you are correct. Alaska has a natural advantage in transportation over a lot of projects because we're 12 to 14 days away on a journey from the Asian market, whereas other parts of the world are anywhere from, you know, 18 to 28 days, depending on if you're in the Gulf of Mexico or the Middle East. So that is a natural advantage, but as a project, we have agreed we want to pursue the broadest market possible because it is so competitive. It gives us the best chance of getting the best price for the LNG. The LNG buyers want to pay us a little bit less than they can pay somebody else. That's how they think. It's so fundamental that gas is a commodity, and in the commodity business, low cost wins. It's not Copper River salmon. I know I say that a lot, but Copper River salmon is a differentiated product. It demands a premium. It's better than other salmon.
And Madam Chair, and I appreciate that answer. So this is probably something we should discuss with the administration, because I think, and since they're listening up, that is one of the questions that we're going to have is, you know, how should we pursue some of those free trade agreements? But then secondly, our competition coming from the Canadian West Coast is going to be the place where we have to think about what those trade advantages are and disadvantages. So that's probably for our administration to tell us more properly than this particular project, although that's a market competition you're going to have to work with, and probably highlights the need to have a competitive advantage as you deal through this. So, but it looks to me like the West Coast Canadian issue would probably be our closest competition for that market. And if they're not limited by free trade agreement issues, or are they, is something that I would probably end up asking our own department to tell us. So I think that's an important part for us to kind of get the context of it, because when you go around and talk to people about the FERC participation, it's not only what's the impact to us, but what is the impact if it doesn't go too. I mean, there's two sides to that impact.
So through the chair, thank you for those points, Senator Coghill. I think the state has a lot of great people working for it through the state gas team and the different consultants the state has built to support the LNG project. And I would not opine to offer anything on marketing because it's probably, you know, borderline illegal. But I would suggest that if we could spend just a second, that discussion about how the state wants to market its gas is a very important element. And the state might want to think about how much the buyers know about its plans for marketing. And it folds back into that broader conversation about how are we going to manage this and how are we going to manage this information flow so that we preserve our competitiveness and we preserve private information. So, but you know, the state's elections there are purely the state's domain, and I wouldn't presume to opine on it. So if I could, I want to just leave the group with a couple messages. I always appreciate the chance to talk about these, if nothing else, because I like to hit these three points. First, Alaska LNG is a large integrated LNG project. It's a lot more than a pipeline. Simply from a cost perspective, the pipeline is only a small portion of the total cost. The majority of the cost are the plants. We can't liquefy the gas unless we clean it up. We can't sell it overseas unless we liquefy it. So it is a large integrated LNG project with the pipeline as a portion of it. Now, the pipeline is a very important portion of it because it allows us to provide gas to Alaskans and it allows us to move gas from the north to the south. But it's only a portion of the project. It also defines how we look at the project. As an integrated project, we're able to regulated under a different section with FERC. It's Section 3, which is for export projects instead of Section 7, which allows us to work in an integrated manner. This is very, very important to us because the resource owners, who are the state, and the parties who have purchased the right to produce the resource through the leases, have the 98% of the gas on the North Slope. So you have all those folks have the opportunity to work together in an integrated manner. What it allows us to do is have the project people talk to the resource people in a way that's never happened before. Previous incarnations of this project were always done under FERC 7, which means there are limitations on data exchange between the project and the resource owners. They still talk to each other. They work together as best they could, but there were limitations on it through regulatory statute. As an integrated project where the resource owners and the project owners are the same group of people, we're not limited by those factors, and because we're not limited, we're able to be much more efficient in our design. We're able to make design decisions in how we build the gas treatment plant and how we integrate the business at Prudhoe Bay that previous projects could not. And those give us big advantages that help us be more competitive, particularly in terms of cost. So it's important that we look at it as a large LNG project. Second, for the large LNG project to be successful, I always like to talk about three things: alignment, risk, and cost. And again, I know a lot of people have heard me say these words many times, so for those folks, I apologize. I'm not trying to be redundant. I'm just trying to offer a framework that can help us answer a lot of the questions like I'm hearing from the committee today. We can test the questions against what does a factor do to alignment? How does it impact risk, and how does it impact cost? The most important project element of success for any mega project is alignment of the parties. It's been benchmarked through a lot of public data. There's a lot of companies that study mega projects, and they always say alignment of the parties and your ability to resolve and move forward, resolve differences and move forward, helps shape effectiveness. So we have a really unique environment here where all the resource owners are working together, and the resource owners include the state. The state, through SB 138, has taken its share of the revenues, which it is entitled to as a factor of the production of the companies that hold the leases, as equity in the project. And that puts everybody in an aligned manner.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Senator Wielkowski, pardon me.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's been some talk about, since we have the new administration, maybe some misalignment among the parties. Do you share that concern, or do you see the new administration still in alignment with on the gas line?
Through the chair, Senator Wielkowski, the life of the Alaska LNG project, I hope, will be measured in decades. There's going to be a lot of political transition. I think the challenge is to preserve the alignment across the parties such that we all continue to work together. I would be happy to say, for the record, that the folks I'm working with from the new administration have been great. I have a lot of respect for them. The words I'm hearing from those folks in private conversation and public conversation talk about, how do we get this project to work? How do we expedite this project? How do we make it work? Those are the same goals and objectives we all share. Now, with that said, I would feel remiss if I didn't say, you know, the previous administration did a tremendous amount of work to make this project happen. They did an excellent job, and I'm very grateful for everything they did. But that transition process can be managed in a manner that we preserve alignment. That's what it's about. To date, I'm very optimistic. I think the folks that I'm working with from the new administration have been great to work with. I look forward to continuing to work with them. So with that said, alignment is everything. I know it sounds simple. Maybe it's just too high level or too simplistic, but preserving alignment is everything. And when we look at questions and we look at challenges, the first thing we should ask ourselves is, how does this factor impact alignment? The second thing we should ask ourselves is, how does it impact risk? Risk is how we move through the gates. Pre-FEED is all about identifying risk, mitigating risks, and reducing uncertainty. And I'll show what that means in terms of progressing the project. But anything that creates risks, anything that creates uncertainty, makes it much more difficult to move the project forward. Because as we move the project forward, the amount of resources, people, money, time required to progress the project increases by factors of 2 and 3. It's not a simple escalation. It's a very abrupt escalation. So you really want to manage risk early and reduce it. So But with that said, alignment and risk tie back to cost. And I know every time I talk, I say cost a million times. One of these days, I'll make the time to sit and listen to myself talk and get a little bingo card and count how many times I say cost. And if I don't say it a whole bunch of times, I probably haven't said it enough, because cost of supply is the fundamental metric that says, how much have I spent to build this project, how much have I spent to operate this project, and how much gas have I delivered to the consumers. And if I take those total dollars and divide them by those total millions of BTUs of energy, or millions of cubic feet, or trillions of cubic feet, whatever metric I want to use, can I deliver that energy to a buyer at a low enough cost that I can compete? Because if you can't compete, we've invested tremendous resources in something that's unsuccessful. And there's an old adage, if you're losing money on a unit basis, don't try and make it up with volume. So this is an enormous project. We have to make sure every one of those molecules has a margin that generates enough return to make the investment and the risk worthwhile for all the owners, the state of Alaska and the other entities. So I always like to talk about alignment, risk, and cost, because it helps us frame all of this in a competitive context. And then the last thing I like to talk about is just our status. We're moving through pre-FEED. We're going really well, but there are some open commercial and fiscal issues that need to be resolved. We had the privilege to talk to the House Resource Committee, had a lot of good conversation on it. I just would like to headline it for this group that, you know, SB 138 offered a roadmap for how to address commercial and fiscal issues such as property tax, royalty structures, fiscal durability, predictability. Those elements are going to be very important as we move from pre-FEED to FEED. It's going to be very difficult to get the owner groups, any owner group, to feel comfortable increasing the investment without some reduction in the uncertainty around these factors. With that said, I want to jump to this next page and talk a little bit about how that would work. You may recognize the top of this page from previous presentations where we talked about a gated project management process. We do different things, we move through different decisions, and we do different levels of work. But after we complete different levels of work, we hit decision points. We call them gates, where we either decide to go forward or we stop. Just to rewind a little bit in history, in 2012 and 2013, the group did concept work. That's where we decided where we would put the GTP, where we would put the LNG plant, how big are these facilities. That's cost a little over $100 million. The state, through AGEA, carried about $28 million. That information allowed us to get to a decision point in the middle of 2014 to ask ourselves whether or not we wanted to move into pre-FEED. Pre-FEED is somewhere on the order of $400 to $500 million. As I mentioned earlier, we've spent 82. So if you take the monies we've spent, which is $100 million plus in concept, $80 million plus to date in pre-FEED, we've spent about $180, $190 million. We're going to spend another $300, $350 million in pre-FEED. That information will allow us to make what we call a FEED decision. FEED is a short way of saying front-end engineering and design. It's the detailed work that really defines how we would build this animal. I often use the metaphor of a house, and again, forgive me for being repetitive. Concept is where you put it. Pre-FEED is kind of how it looked, but FEED is really detailed work. Every nut, every bolt, how do you get it, how do you move it? And that allows you to make the decision, does it make sense? Is this a place I want my family to live for 30 years? Is this a plant that can be successfully operated for 30 years? Can I deliver the gas at a low enough cost of supply that I can be competitive and generate a big enough margin to generate an adequate return? Because at that decision to build the project, or final investment decision, which we of course have an acronym, FID, and I appreciate Senator Giesel's reminder that I should remind my acronyms. We engineers are very lazy with words. We're good with numbers, but lazy with words. That allows us the privilege to spend $45 to $65 billion. So if you kind of add it all up, at FID, we're going to spend somewhere on the order of $2 to $3 billion just to decide if I want to build the project. And so you'll want to know, before I put up all that money, can I get a regulatory permit to build it? How do I feel about the environmental impact statement? How do I feel about the federal construction permits? How do I feel about the export licenses? Do I have authorizations to sell to non-FTA countries as well as FTA countries? Can I manage those risks? And if so, am I ready to step up and spend those monies? Those are the challenges we ask ourselves in that broader process. And we do it with phased gates to allow us to measure uncertainty, reduce uncertainty as we increase resource. Here in the pre-FEED phase, which is the blue box where we are now, I wanted to spend a little time in the bottom part of the page looking at 2014, 2015, and 2016. You can see a line where we are here at the end of June. To date, we've completed the summer field work. We've submitted some of the resource reports, and we've built the teams. We're well along the progress path of finishing what we call the JVA work products. Those are the things that tell us exactly how we would design and build this set of facilities. What kind of machinery would we use? What kind of compressors would we use? How would we lay them out? How would we position? How do we test the hydraulics, thermal efficiency? All those things we hope to have done in the fourth quarter of 2015. We then move into an optimization phase where we make sure all those pieces work together. That's in parallel with a technical owner review process. And again, when I talk about owners, I want to be really clear. I'm including the state of Alaska through its representatives, you know, either the commissioners or however it chooses to be involved. All those owners want to see that information in a way that makes them confident that at the end of pre-FEED, we'll have spent $100 million for concept, $450 million for pre-FEED. So call it $500 million. Gives me the right to spend $1 to $3 billion in FEED. We're spending about $25 to $30 million a month right now. If we go into FEED, we'll spend well in excess of $100 million a month. If we go into construction, that number will go up much higher. We'll be spending, you know, millions a day. It's that escalation process that is the background for that communication and that decision process, always driving down risk and uncertainty. In orange, you go ahead.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Walikowski.
Will you be evaluating only a plan line down to Nikiski, or are you looking potentially at Valdez or another location?
Through the chair, we made line routing decisions and plant location decisions in concept. We're revisiting some of those elements in pre-FEED, so I don't want to say it with 100% certainty, but our resources are focused on the LNG plant in the Nikiski industrial area at this time. Now, we may move because we're gathering a lot of data, and I'm going to show you how we're doing that. So there's a chance that may move. But in the concept work, we tested dozens of alternatives across the state, and we selected the Nikiski industrial area because we think it has the lowest profile for risk and cost. I'll show you some information that helps us make that decision. It's basically a very big flat space, which means we don't have to spend a lot of civil work. Reduces our environmental impact. Some of the other places we looked at would have had to have 30 to 35,000 cubic meters of rock moved. It's very expensive, has huge impacts on the environment that we'd like to avoid. We also looked at the pipeline routing that made it most expeditious to source gas to Alaskans. We looked at operability. What does the weather do? What are the snow loads? Some of the snow loads in some of these locations are enormous. So we looked at a whole range of factors that gave us a sense that the project as designed with its current route and its current plant locations is the right place to focus our energy for pre-FEED. So we're focused there. It's not done until the FERC work is done, but that's where we're trying to make it work.
Just brief follow-up if I could, Madam Chair. And I've had people in my office, and I hear all different things. Everybody's sort of lobbying where it should go. But one of the concerns that I've heard is that the water depth in Nikiski versus a greater depth in Valdez, and I assume that's something you've taken a pretty solid look at.
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Walikowski, I'll answer that, but a couple slides in, I'm going to show you some pictures on that. It's very important to remember LNG carriers are very different than crude tankers. Crude tankers carry a, you know, heavier, denser liquid. They draft 100 to 110 feet. LNG carrier drafts 40 to 45 feet. Water depth is a very different animal for an LNG carrier. So we can show you, I'll show you some pictures on the work we've done there. And we've done a lot of work on that to give us comfort that the sites as we're working them are the place to start. Now, I won't guarantee it's the place we're going to finish, because you don't know that until you work through the FERC process and finish the EIS, but this is where we're focused. And we gather a lot of that data through these summer field works and these orange lines and the resource reports to support that. So let me jump to the next page. And
yes, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, the Chair. I know I don't think few places can match Kenai for flat, I guess, but what discussions just in general about the Mat-Su and the opportunities? Is there more available land, a deep water port with infrastructure?
through the chair, Senator Stoltz. If you want to talk about the west side of the Cook Inlet, you have much shallower water. You have different metocean packing issues. If we thought we could avoid crossing the Cook Inlet in a manner that would be effective, we'd probably give it a lot of consideration. We've had great meetings with the mayor of the Mat-Su Borough and development folks there. We've looked at that very hard. They're on the list. There are different things that would be required, but we think that the combination of pipeline approach characteristics, construction characteristics, and operation characteristics make the Nikiski Industrial Area a better choice. And again, I'll show you a couple pictures.
Okay. It's not just that we're not flat enough.
It's a whole range of topics, and I'll talk about it some more. But to ground everybody in the work at the resource level, Point Thompson and Prudhoe Bay provide the resource. It's 32 to 35 trillion cubic feet of gas. All the work in the units managed by the unit operators under the unit joint operating agreements, but we work together on a very close basis to make sure the design of the project is as efficient as possible. At Prudhoe Bay, I'd like to point everybody to the picture in the lower left, which shows all the interconnects that we'd have, how we'd manage CO2, how we'd re-inject the CO2, how we'd integrate with the existing facilities. It's a fundamental strength of this project that previous incarnations really didn't have, but it's also a very important long-term characteristic and risk that the fundamental design of the project relies on a healthy Prudhoe Bay to give us compression facilities and wells and source the gas. So it's very important that, you know, Prudhoe Bay operators have done a great job running these facilities, and we need that infrastructure to source the gas to the project so we don't have to create it, which would be a cost drag. So it's an important element of the project. At Point Thompson, the balance of the gas, about 25% of the total gas, would be sourced. You can see in the upper right a picture of what the initial production system at Point Thompson looks like in September of 2014. We've finished the design work in the lower right of what we have to do to add compression and add work for gas expansion, and this is the kind of work that's getting done to support the Alaska LNG project, so we know the equipment sizing, we know the modules, we know how we'd manage all that. So that work's been done. What the two resources do is source gas to the gas treatment plant. So we provide about 3/4 of what we need from Prudhoe Bay and about 1/4 of what we need from Point Thompson, and they bring that gas to the gas treatment plant. It's about 3 billion cubic feet of gas at a peak winter rate. It's important that when we talk about it, engineers use lots of different numbers. We use average annual rates. We use peak winter stream day rates, and the reason for that is demand for gas goes up when it's cold. People use a lot more gas to heat their homes when it's cold than in the peak of summer. The state of Alaska is a great example. Here in the summer, gas demand can fall as low as 50 to 70 million cubic feet of gas a day. In the winter, it can rise as high as 400. So what we've done is built this facility so that it can handle those big swings in the winter and sized it appropriately. So it handles about 2.4 billion cubic feet a day for export, about 400 to 500 for in-state use, with the balance for fuel in the gas treatment plant, the compression facilities, and the LNG plant. It's modularized, which means it's built in chunks that are moved in. I like to talk about the size of the facility a little bit. I'll maybe show you on a picture, but it's 250,000 tons of steel. That's the size of a Nimitz-class aircraft carrier. I think people got tired of me comparing it to Ford pickups, so I'm switching to aircraft carriers. It's just a tremendous amount of steel, and it has to be moved in about in chunks between 3 and 9,000 tons a pop. So it's a lot of modules that have to be moved very carefully, and I'll show you how we've designed that here in a second. We're doing our geotechnical work and our sea lift strategies to make sure we can move all this, and we're also looking at the fabrication. The reason I talk about fabrication is I'm going to show you a video in about 2 seconds that you can see the tower. And I just want to point out that the tower you're looking at is 130 feet tall. It's 28 feet in diameter, but the steel walls are 12 to 14 inches thick. So we have to be able to take a single piece of steel that's that thick and roll it, which is very specialized, and it's a very difficult task to build these vessels. But we have confirmed our ability to fabricate and move these vessels. So I'm going to show you the design work we've done. There's a cutaway in the lower right, but I'm going to show you this video real quick. In the video, what you're going to see is a bunch of different colors as we cut through it. Those colors are different process streams whether it's treated gas or methane or some of the reagent streams. They're all different colors, and we're going to take different layers. I say this because this video is only going to last about a minute, and I can't talk as fast as the video moves. But it's an excerpt from a tool that we have where people can work in real-time 3D and move around to their heart's content. We do that to make sure that our designs are as efficient as possible from a hydraulic and thermal perspective. So here we go. Let's see if I can get this to wake up. So that's an overview. You can see the size of the trains. Each one of those trains would fill a football field. If Senator Stoltz and I are big football fans, you could take one of those and it would fill a football stadium. It's about 140 feet tall. Each one of those is somewhere on the order of 80 to 90,000 tons. This is a cutaway of one of the three trains. Each of those colors is a different process train. As this picture turns, look at the door. You can see that little door? That's 8 feet tall. So I'm trying to use that as the scale of how large this is. And as we cut away, you can see what we're looking at now is the inside structure. Each of those structures is a module that we bring in and we stack. I used to use the Lego analogy, but I didn't think it really was fitting for something that's technologically complex, so I try not to use it anymore, but it's basically big blocks that we bring in. And as we cut it away, you can see that in the center is the main reaction tower where we use amine to separate the non-hydrocarbon elements from the hydrocarbon elements, and then we reboil it. We take the CO2, we put it back into Prudhoe Bay, and we take the methane and the other hydrocarbon components, and we put it in the pipeline, and we move that down to Nikiski. So that's a design model. This is just an excerpt from a tool that we have where we've designed all the elements of the plant, and we use this to kind of virtually operate it and make sure it's as efficient as possible. This is done in parallel with a GTP design where we have a large imaging system where we can use stereoscopic cameras flown by helicopters to image the entire pipeline, everywhere from Point Thompson to Prudhoe Bay, Prudhoe Bay down to the Cook Inlet, as well as each of the plant sites. And this allows us to look at each of the plant sites in great detail and make sure that as we do geotechnical and geoseismic modeling, we really understand the environment we're working in. So I'm going to show you a little bit of an excerpt here. What I'd like to say is that kind of orange line that moves from the center where the black triangle is to the right, that's the line from Prudhoe Bay to Point Thompson. And then you see the red line moving from the north to the south. That's the main pipeline. The little black arrow is a location marker of where the GTP is. And the reason that matters is you can move that little black arrow in this system anywhere and look at anywhere on the pipeline route at every foot of the mile in any dimension. So I've just made a little film excerpt, which is the inset window of what the GTP location would look like. So I'm going to start it, and it'll scroll here for about 20 seconds. As you move around, you can see you can see the Beaufort in the background. That's the gas plant at Prudhoe Bay. This big flat area is the proposed location. And we use these tools to make sure we understand gravel sources, water sources, siting. And we can do that anywhere on the pipeline in any dimension, at any of the sites. And these are the tools that we've been building, and that's why I bring it here to show the kind of work we're doing. So with that said, that's the gas treatment plant. Now, from the gas treatment plant, we go into the pipeline. A lot of folks think when we talk about the pipeline, it's just one big piece of pipe. You cut a trench or put in some sleepers and put in the pipe and you're done. But I wanted to use the opportunity today to kind of point out that the pipeline is a lot more complex than that. The pipeline goes through multiple environments, multiple design regimes. So starting at Point Thompson, you can see a little green arrow between Point Thompson and Prudhoe Bay. That's an above-ground line for gas between Point Thompson and the GTP. It's one different regime. It's an above-ground line. It's got a different design characteristic. You then see kind of a dark gray line between Point Thompson and a point directly to the south as you're moving. That's Attigan Pass. That is a continuous permafrost area, which is a conventional pipeline design because that's always cold. It's continuous permafrost. The ground's always frozen, and the majority of this line would be buried there because the ground's cold and the pipe's cold and nothing ever moves. Once we move over Attigan Pass, we move down into the interior, and you can see there's a red line that comes to just about the back of the Alaska Range. That red line is the central section where the strains and the loads are much more difficult because, as everybody here knows, the interior of Alaska is very warm in the summer and very cold in the winter. So you have 150-degree swings over the course of a year, which means the ground is in motion. As the ground freezes, it actually heaves. It expands, just like an ice cube. If you think of an ice cube, when you drop it in the water, the level rises. As it melts, it falls. It's because the process of freezing heaves the ground. So as it gets hotter, it's also in motion. So this is a very important characteristic of it, because the ground is a difficult environment. We have to be very careful with our design. Once we get onto the back of the Alaska Range, you can see we move back into a conventional design range, because we don't have the temperature swings here in the south-central portion of the state. And then we need an offshore section across the Cook Inlet. So when we talk about the pipeline, we're actually talking about five different regimes. Now, with that said, we've started a pipeline testing process. We've gone out and acquired some pipe. We've got a work order for $2.5 million worth of pipe from a mill to see who can source it. We've talked to about 12 mills in North America, 2 in Canada, 10 in the lower 48, to see who can make this pipe. We've talked to about as many in Asia. And what we're learning is not a lot of folks can make pipe this big. Up to 42 inch, we think there may be one or two in North America, that can handle it. If we go above 42, there's no one in North America that can handle it. It would have to go to Asia. And I wanted to just take everybody's indulgence and show different types of pipe. So if you guys will indulge me, because we have different loads and different types, there's different kinds of pipe. So in the lower right is a picture of how we make LSAW pipe, or linear weld or longitudinal welds. And it's basically, we take a big heavy piece of steel. This is about an inch thick, a piece of steel an inch thick, and we fold it into a U. And then we roll it over, or the mill rolls it over, and then welds it, and that creates a pipe. And that's called LSAW, or longitudinal weld, and that's the picture in the lower right. It's a very strong pipe. It's difficult to make because the weld has to be stronger than the body of the pipe. So it's difficult to make, and it's very expensive, and it takes a lot of technology. A little bit simpler type of design is what's called a helical weld, or a helical pipe, which is HSAW, which is the bottom left, where we take the pipe and we roll it, or the mills roll it, kind of like that. And a good example of that is what you'd see in a tube from a paper towel. So you can see that it's basically a helically welded pipe. And I use this as an analogy to show that a volume of weld in this is much greater than in a longitudinal weld, which means its loading and its characteristics are different. I take a couple minutes of your time to show that, because there's many different types of pipe that can be sourced from many different mills that have to fit five different regimes. So what we're in the process of doing is testing different welding procedures and different material sourcing procedures to try and find out which mills have the capability to provide this pipe at the low enough cost. I haven't said cost in a while, so I wanted to throw that out there. And we want to make sure that we understand how we would build it. So it's an iterative process where we're got some pipe in different grades, X70, X80. They have different characteristics, different wall thicknesses, different factors allowed. So what we're trying to figure out, what is the right type of pipe? Where do we get it? How do we weld it? How do we handle it? And that's what the pipeline team is doing right now. They're also gathering a lot of geotechnical data. They're working with the regulators, FERC and PHMSA. And the goal is to make sure that the cost and schedule characteristics are as carefully defined as possible. The other thing the pipeline team is doing...
Could you tell us what PHMSA means?
Oh, I'm sorry. I almost slipped one by you. It's the Pipeline Hazardous Safety Materials Agency. It's the federal regulator that works on pipelines.
Thank you.
They work with FERC. FERC is the umbrella organization, but PHMSA has permitting authority over pipelines. It's a lot easier to say PHMSA than Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Agency. I can never remember if that A is agency or administration, so I have to check that one.
We'll wait with bated breath.
I'll send you an email on that one. So the Alaska LNG project and AGDC are continuing to cooperate. At the last review, we had an update on that cooperation. I want to provide another update. My first thanks for AGDC is I'd like to thank my friend Fritz Krusen, who works for AGDC, who helped me come up with an excellent helical pipe example. Thank you, Fritz. But in addition to cooperating on models for pipe, we're cooperating on all the data and all the design work for the pipeline design. One thing we've done that is the most important of all is we've harmonized the routes. So all the different pipeline routing that's being looked at to move gas from north to south has a common route now, which means we're gathering one set of data. We shared all the historical data. TAPS data was owned by the folks who built TAPS. Denali and APP was different groups of people. ASAP had data, and what we've agreed is all four of those data sets come into one pod, and we're sharing it. We're also working to share those resources as we move forward. You can see a list of the studies we're doing, geotechnical programs, aerial mapping, environmental field data, fault studies, infrastructure studies. Those are all very important elements of making sure the pipeline has the lowest risk and lowest cost possible. And you can see a map on the right side of the places where we're doing frost heave studies. That's where ice is moving the line, and you can see places where we're drilling boreholes and sharing data. So we continue to work with AGDC to make sure that we're as efficient as possible. With that said, I want to show a quick video of the pipeline route. Again, this is from a very large interactive database. We can look at any dimension. We can turn left. We can turn right. We can go up. We can go down anywhere on the pipeline. So I'm going to just show you a segment of the back of the Brooks Range going into Attigan, but we can do this anywhere on the pipe for all 800 miles in any dimension. So it's a pretty simple video. We looked at showing you guys all 800 miles, but it was a pretty long video, and we'll just go with a little snippet here. But that's the Dalton Highway moving up towards Attigan. Once the pipeline comes all the way down to the south, it gets to the LNG plant. The LNG plant was permitted in the export authorization for 20 million metric tons. 20 million metric tons is about 2.5 billion cubic feet of gas a day. To try and put that into context, it's 10 times the average use of the state of Alaska. It's about one-third of what an industrial country the size of Germany, the UK, or Canada would use. It's an enormous plant. This one plant would source one-third of all of Germany's gas needs. So it's not a small plant. The way we've designed that demand, to meet that demand, is three modularized 6MT trains. And a million metric tons is what MTA means, and it's a volume of LNG that you create by compressing and liquefying a volume of gas. It takes about 800 million cubic feet of gas a day to generate 1 million metric tons of, or 5 million metric tons of LNG. So each one of these trains is about 800 million cubic feet of gas, or about 2.4 billion cubic feet of gas in total. The reason we pick these trains is they're kind of in the middle. There are smaller trains, and there are bigger trains. The bigger trains have much larger drivers, and they're very efficient for very large resources. The smaller trains are better fits for smaller resources. So what we try to do is match the size of this design and these trains to the size of the resource so that we have about 20, 25 years of plateau and can source gas over a 30-year period, which is the period we requested in our export authorization. So that's how we size them. We size them around the resource that's known, which is, again, 32 to 35 trillion cubic feet of gas. The team's done all the engineering work around a selected liquefaction technology. The liquefaction technology that was selected is the most common liquefaction technology. These train sizes are actually the most common train sizes. The reason we did that was to reduce risk. We know these trains. We know this technology. The process design on that picture is a little hard to see up there, so hopefully on your paper you can see all the different elements, and don't worry, I won't drag anybody through it. They're just different ways of making gas cold. It starts at 30 degrees Fahrenheit, just below freezing. It gets down to minus 260, which is very, very cold. And the challenge with LNG manufacture is everything that is in a gas stream that isn't methane will freeze before the methane does. So we have to have the gas very clean, and we have to have all of the non-methane elements other than C3+. You can get away with a little ethane or C2. But anything else will freeze up and cause operational problems. So that's why we clean it, that's how we process it, and that's how we make it cold. I also wanted to share with everybody the site, and Senator Wilikowski asked a great question on how do we select the site, and I'll show you a picture on why it's flat, but there's a wide range of characteristics. The infrastructure is very important. You know, we can land 737s in Kenai. That allows us to move equipment. There's an existing infrastructure facility there. That's very, very important to us because the workforce to build this plant is going to be somewhere on the order of 3,000 to 3,500 people, plus or minus. We want to be able to have an infrastructure to move those people around. Some of the places on the west side of the inlet, particularly as you move to the south, you'd have to pretty much start over. So we want to leverage existing infrastructure. We want to leverage what's there. We also want to minimize our environmental impact. So the less civil work we have to do, the better. It's a lot better from an environmental impact statement. It's a lot better from a cost perspective. So I'll show you some more of that work. Then the other thing is operating it. The snow loads here are a little lower than in other parts of the state. You know, some parts of the state have up over 300 inches. It would be impossible to run an LNG plant in that environment because an LNG plant, unlike other industrial facilities, requires constant care and attention. It has a lot of moving parts. It has a lot of different elements to it, so you want to be able to access it all the time and take care of it. So you want to have good environmental characteristics. Now, with that said, I think there's a great analog in this picture at the top of the page. You can see three little dots, and that's the Kenai LNG facility that ConocoPhillips has operated for 40 years. They've never missed a cargo. They've never had an issue. And it's a demonstration of that area has kind of a history of demonstrated success with LNG manufacture. So all those characteristics kind of roll together as part of a very, very large, very, very detailed analysis and give us a sense that this is the area we want to try to make it work first. Now, we think there's a couple other places that can work, three or four, but in the resource reports and in our land acquisition process, this is the place where we're focusing. This is another great place to talk a little bit about confidentiality. We're acquiring land. We think that it's important to respect the privacy of the landowners and make sure that the deals that are done in a manner that work for all parties. We talk about fair and durable deals. To date, most of the feedback we receive is that the parties that are acquiring land and having their land acquired feel very good about the project that they've worked with. They've been treated fairly. And that's really important to us because we want to be a good neighbor. We think we're going to be there for decades. So we want to make sure that all deals from day one are fair and durable and that we start out from day one and for the next several decades, we're a good neighbor. We talk about a 30-year life in this project. That's the export application. But the Kenai facility has been there over 40 years. Alaska has cold, dry air. Cold, dry air is great for compression equipment. We'd like to see this plant operate well past 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, 60 years. So we think about that in our design process and making sure it can run a long time.
Senator Wilikowski.
So have you ruled out Anchorage as a location?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, there would be a lot of challenges to working in Anchorage. And we did look at Anchorage. As you move up the Cook Inlet, some of the ice loads are a lot higher. As you move towards the Anchorage area, it's hard to find the amount of acreage we'd need in a manner that's contiguous, that could be acquired, and has access to the port. You want to be able to have enough land to build the facility, which we put in the resource reports is somewhere on the order of 600 to 800 acres, and have it right by the water. So it's very hard to find that. You know, there's some places on the west side, as you mentioned, where you can get that, but you want to look at a balance of characteristics, and this is the place where we're starting. We haven't ruled anything out, and nothing's done until the resource reports are done and the EIS is done, but this is the place where we're focusing and we're acquiring the acreage required to support the export authorization. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission won't pursue EISs on projects that don't own acreage. It's one of the three characteristics. You must be able to demonstrate that you own or control resource. You must be able to demonstrate that you own or can manage technology. Fortunately, with the parties here, the four parties involved, the state, BP, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, have 98% of the known resource, so we meet that first test. We also have a history of LNG production. The three producer entities are three of the five largest LNG companies in the world. So we can meet that second test. So we acquire this land to meet the third test, and that is what enables the FERC process. You can't enter FERC without a site.
Did you have a question, Senator Schultz?
Chair, following up on Senator Wilikowski, if I might.
Mm-hmm. Please.
You know, up until, I guess, I'm looking at the calendar, 59, 60 days ago, it seems like on the politics was all pipes leading to Nikiski, and now we're in a different paradigm. And it just, I don't know, I guess I just want to make sure that we have done a due diligence on all other locations because we have a new, fresh set of eyes, different eyes on this whole issue, and I think it would be remiss if there wasn't a solid second look on that, whether it was Mat-Su or Valdez, and there certainly has been a level of politics leading to the pipes leading to Nikiski, and I think the public would have a greater degree of confidence in whatever ultimate decision is made if there's a real open evaluation with a lot of discussions. Other, just on the record.
Thank you, Senator.
Through the chair, I appreciate that. I can tell you that we've had those 65 to 75 communities sessions I mentioned, a lot of them were in those communities. We took the design criteria and the site selection criteria and sat down with the mayor of the Mat-Su Borough and showed him how we got to the decision. We sat down with the Valdez City Council, and then current Governor Walker was in attendance. We sat down for 3 hours and went through all these decisions and the criteria and the designs, and all that material is available. We'd be happy to ensure that the right representatives of the state, possibly through the Department of Natural Resources, see it again.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Sulcich.
You know, and on those meetings, there was a certain different dynamic. Governor Walker was sitting in the back row then, and well, I'll just leave that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'll let you proceed.
So let me just show you a little bit more on the site. Let me help look at the characteristic of the site. So here's a video of what the site looks like. To the left edge is the Tesoro Refinery. You can see that this is largely uninhabited, fairly flat land, and that's an important characteristic. But it's also got an existing industrial infrastructure. So those are two important characteristics. And so this is a video of the site, and you can see what it looks like. And as you move across the site, you move towards the coast. And there in the far distance, you can see the edge of the refinery. So that's the site. Now, to make sure that the site's really a good choice, we have to do a lot more work than just say it looks nice on paper and it has good infrastructure and it has good pipeline access characteristics and it has good civil environmental characteristics. We do a lot of due diligence on the site itself and make sure that the soils are acceptable. The LNG plant weighs about 200,000 tons. The compression equipments are very heavy. We want to make sure that the soils and the foundation designs are proper to carry that load. So we do what's called geotechnical work, where we drill boreholes. We take cuttings all the way down to about 150 feet, recover the samples, and then study them. We've done about 30. We have another 150 to go. I just want to show you this. I'd like to thank KTVA Channel 11 for this. I always like to say we borrowed their video because we wanted to save a little bit on cost. So here we are gathering the borehole. You can see that he's clearing the soil or the sediments that have been recovered. This is how we recovered. It's a rotary top drive, which spins an open bore. The mud is the return. And they're gathering the samples. We bag every sample for every foot of every borehole we drill. And then we go back and we test it across the whole range of the site to make sure that the site has the geotechnical characteristics to handle the loads of the plant. So that work's been done over the last 3 months.
Senator Welikowski had a question.
The proposed site is, it's in Cook Inlet. It's obviously home to millions of salmon that come back, certainly hundreds of thousands. And is there dredging that will be necessary there? Do you anticipate any fishery issues?
Let me show you this map through the chair, Senator Welikowski. Let me show you this map of what we're doing to understand the inlet. We have selected to stay north of the Kenai River to minimize any impact on salmon. We know there are fisheries in the area. We want to minimize any impact on them. We've opened up conversations with the borough and the Department of Natural Resources on how we're going to manage that. But part of the environmental impact statement and part of the assessment process is to demonstrate there's no adverse impact on fisheries. I don't expect any because our impact in the water is really pretty limited. But let me show you how that will work. What we do is we have an array of tools that we use, 2D side scan sonar, two-dimensional seismic, and different tools to map the inlet. So this is a video of that work in progress. You can see that tube on the side of the boat. That's actually a side scan sonar tool that, right there that he'll drag. That'll image the bottom. It's 2D seismic in the back and sonar underneath the vessel. Then we add that to a bunch of other data that we capture to get very, very detailed maps of the inlet. And we also have years of data that have been captured on the metocean characteristics, tides, currents, the other characteristics of the inlet to make sure that the shipping can be managed safely. We all know there's a lot of concern there, but I can suggest that, you know, there's been 40 years of LNG carriers working safely in the Cook Inlet. I also like to point out that LNG carriers are very different than crude carriers. Alaska has a long history of understanding crude carriers. They're very heavy. They're about the same size, but that difference in draft is really important. Crude carriers draft more than twice what an LNG carrier does. So when we understand that, we get different needs.
Yes, Senator Welikowski.
The
Are the carriers similar to the carriers that are going into Nikiski now for the LNG plant, number one? And number two, do you anticipate any dredging that's necessary?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, they're similar. The ones that have gone into the Cook Inlet are on the smaller side. They've been 80 to 90. Just to keep things messy, we measure LNG rates in terms of billions of cubic feet a day. We measure volumes of LNG manufactured in millions of metric tons, but when it's on a boat, it's measured in cubic meters. So a traditional vessel calling in Nikiski is somewhere between 80 and 90,000 cubic meters. Really, really large LNG carriers that you see on the press, like in the Middle East, they're anywhere between 215,000 and 265,000 cubic meters. The vessels that we plan to use are what are called conventionals. They'll be somewhere on the order of 150 to 165. Last year, the Kenai LNG facility, the existing facility, brought in a vessel of about 130, same length, same beam, just a little bit less capacity. So they're similar, but they're not as big as the big ships, and they're not as little as the little ships. They're kind of in between. Now, to your second question, do I anticipate dredging? I think it's too early to say. We certainly don't want to dredge. There are dredging operations up there now. One reason we don't want to dredge is it has an environmental impact, plus it has a cost. So our intent is to design the jetty so that we don't have to dredge, but we need to work with the FERC, the U.S. Coast Guard, through what's called a waterway suitability assessment, and other mechanisms to test how long is that jetty, where is that jetty, and, you know, as we understand the bottom of the inlet, is there any characteristic that would require any kind of dredging, either for initial construction or for operation? And from a cost perspective and environmental perspective, we are trying to make sure we don't have to do that, but it's too early to say with confidence one way or the other.
Follow up, Senator Wilkos.
Do you have any sense, how many ships would you be looking at coming in per day or per week, and then how many are coming in now?
Well, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the current operation in the Kenai LNG facility, I think, is only doing a ship once in a while, pretty limited shipping, because the volumes in the inlet are mainly consumed for in-state use. There's not much being exported. With that said, the volumes of ships we're looking at here, given the journey distance that Senator Coghill referenced earlier, would translate to one ship about every 2 to 3 days. So a conventional cargo about every 2 to 3 days, where a conventional cargo is on the order of 150,000 cubic meters. If you look at those tanks, it's 360,000 cubic meter tanks. Each one of those tanks is about the volume you put on a ship. So you'll fill up those tanks every 3 days, and you'll want to bring in a ship to offload each of those tanks. So the volume in a tank and the volume in the ship is about the same.
Yes,
slightly different topic. So to build the LNG plant, is the plan to ship everything into the port of Anchorage and then truck it down to Kenai, or what's your plan? Can you bring it right into Kenai?
Through the chair, could I get a clarification? Are you asking about how you'd source gas into Anchorage?
No, I'm sorry. Building the LNG facility.
Okay. Through the chair, to build the LNG facility, you'd build an offloading facility at the site. You would... To move it into Anchorage and truck it would be an enormous burden on everybody. So you build an offloading facility where you can move what you need in. What we can source in-state, we would source in-state. But again, that's why infrastructure is so important. You know, you want to be able to move different goods in different ways. So access by air is very important. So those characteristics all come together to give us a sense that the Nikiski industrial area is the place we wanted to start because of the existing infrastructure, the civil requirements, and the operability. Does that help?
Sure. I just want to note, we have reached 5 o'clock, but this is very engaging information. So with the committee's allowance, we'll go ahead and continue. There's just a few more slides, and it's great information. Okay. Senator Stoltz.
On the first of Senator Wilkowski's 4 or 5 questions, he asked about, Madam Chair asked about, I guess, potentially some of the environmental or the habitat type issues. I'm looking at the Mat-Su Borough on a land-based operation with a rail operation. One of the fine citizens of the Kenai Peninsula has probably cost us $7 or $8 million to date on litigation. The guy from Cook Inlet Keeper, who's also involved with Cook Inlet Aquaculture. I mean, I can't imagine they'd go swim in that other pool as well if they came after land-based operations quite a ways away.
on rail and significant litigation. We've had to spend a lot of money in the Ninth Circuit successfully, but at a high cost. Are those guys, they don't, do they sue themselves in their own area? It seems like that, you mentioned the issue of habitat, and whether or not it's real or not, whether what the likelihood of litigation and the cost, because I know what it's cost the borough on a much smaller project.
Forgive me, through the chair, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Okay, you, on the issue of issues, you kind of dismiss the issue of habitat issues. No problem.
No one's dismissing these.
Well, you were okay. You were less than you didn't express the level of concern that the senator did. We'll put it that way. The issue of potential litigation. They've sued the heck out of us there, and those same folks live down there. Are they going to leave you alone?
Through the chair.
There's a deal cut with it. I mean, I don't.
I'm not sure I follow the question. There's no active litigation. We don't expect any litigation.
So it's just against the Matt Sue there. Okay, that's pretty typical.
Thank you, Senator.
No, but the issue there about litigation.
I appreciate you bringing that up. I'll let you go ahead and continue.
Okay. Just as a comment, you know, there's a lot of important things that the Matsu Borough can do. I mean, a lot of the pipe and everything will want to be moved up through there. We have had great conversations with the folks in the Economic Development Office and the mayor, and I think we have a really good relationship there. So if there's something missing, we'll do some homework and follow up.
Just one last minor thing, more of a comment than anything else. But I you know, the pipe has got to be very expensive. I don't know how much it is per mile, but it would seem to me like putting it in Matsu or putting it in Anchorage and saving, you'd save quite a bit of miles and crossing over the Cook Inlet, which you're going to get engaged in beluga whale issues and other endangered species issues, I'm sure. I guess I would just ask, I would agree with Senator Stultz, that's something I would hope you'd take a good hard look at.
Okay, through the chair, thanks for the comment. And when you reference offloading materials, maybe I misunderstood. I thought you were talking about the materials to build the LNG plant. Okay, the materials to build the LNG plant would be taken to the LNG plant site. You wouldn't move it. You move them as little as possible. To your point about the pipe, you would move that to the west side of the inlet directly. You would not bring that to Anchorage. You would not bring that to Nikiski and route it. You take it directly to the west side, and there are port facilities there that we've already talked about that would be ideal.
And not to belabor, but putting it in, it would seem to me that you'd save quite a few miles by putting it in Matsu or Anchorage than having the pipe have to go across the inlet. It would seem to me that you'd save some miles of pipe,
okay,
50, 100 miles, I don't know.
Through the chair, you're absolutely right. Crossing the inlet is difficult and expensive. The challenge in constructing on the west side of the inlet is the nature of the marine characteristics, the nature of the ice flows, and the way the winter snow ice packs. There's the forelands move the ice, which is why the existing industrial area was sited there in the 60s and why shipping has been able to be successful there for 40 years. If you go over to the west side, it's a lot more difficult. And since the LNG plant does its peak demand work in the winter, we'll have probably every 2 days a vessel in the winter. So we have to be very thoughtful of that. And we're very careful with how we have thought through the marine design. And if you move to the west, that's a challenge. And as you move to the north, it's the same. I mean, the city of Anchorage receives everything through, through the shipping up the inlet. But to bring everything up there and find a site is very difficult. So the pipe is designed to come down to the backside so you can get into the grid and source gas to Anchorage. But to actually build the pipe or to build the LNG plant there would be very difficult and very expensive. So it's cheaper to cross the inlet. If we could avoid crossing the inlet, we would. But it doesn't make any sense. And when you look at the bathymetry, there's a channel on the east side that's much deeper. It is not shared on the west side. And that's what the modeling shows, and that's what, you know, the traditional fishing charts would show too. So that's why the industrial area was put there 40, 50 years ago, and that's why they've been able to successfully manage marine traffic for so long. But to your point, you make a great point, and you want to put the pipe where you need it on the west, and you put the plant where you need it on the east. That's how it's done. So let me just show a little bit more on the regulatory process, and I'll be very quick. We've talked a little bit about the export permit, and we've gotten great support from the Department of Energy. I really appreciate everything they've done. They've taken Alaska outside the lower 48 permit process, and they've treated it separately. Secretary Menez, Deputy Secretary Smith have been just really great to work with, and they've supported it. We've done a lot of summer field work to get our data for regulatory. You can see some pictures here on the right side of the work we do. One picture is archaeology. We dig a lot of holes to make sure there's no cultural heritage or sites of archaeological significance. And then we do a lot of work with waterways, which is over on the other side. And you can see some safety awards that were handed out to build the right safety culture. All of this goes together to capture the data, and that data is what goes into the resource reports, and I'll show you that on the next page. In the bottom left, we just have what we call our family tree of all the folks who work on the summer field season. We're pretty proud of how much work they've done. They've walked about 10,000 acres. They safely drove somewhere on the order of 200,000 miles. That's 13 trips around the earth. They've done it all safely, and they've done a really good job. So what I'd like to do is go a little bit further into the regulatory process. FERC is the agency that leads, and I always get this wrong, it's the National Environmental Protection Act process. If the act enshrines the EIS creation, and FERC is the umbrella for all the agencies we work with. Now, to support FERC and all the agencies we work with, the federal government, through the Department of Energy, has created an interagency working group that brings all these different parties together to talk about the regulatory process and how the federal government can support and get the information they need for the permitting process. So we have FERC guiding the agencies, and we have the interagency working group pulling them all together. So FERC is kind of part of the interagency working group, but FERC is in charge, and the interagency working group is an administrative arm that's led through the Department of Energy by Deputy Secretary of the DOI. His name's Tommy Boudreau. He's a native Alaskan, and he's really been very helpful. All that work goes together to create these resource reports. They're listed on the right. There's 13 of them. The ones in light blue, number 1 and 10, are done and have been submitted. The other 10 of the first 12 are largely done, and we hope to submit them pretty soon. The reason this is important, as I mentioned earlier, as soon as these reports are submitted, they trigger a change in the process, and FERC takes over the stakeholder engagement. It takes over the community engagement process and that communication transparency process that we consider so vital to moving the project forward. So issues like how the different boroughs view the pipe and how the different communities view issues like fisheries and other issues is part of this process. So when Senator Wilikowski or Senator Stoltz asked these questions, those are the same kind of questions the communities raised with FERC, and we answer through this process. We don't have answers to it today because we have to have those answers in conjunction with FERC. FERC doesn't want to know what we think. FERC wants to know what the stakeholders think and how we address those concerns. So we do it together, and that creates some transparency and hopefully the buy-in we need. Some of the questions that FERC likes to ask are listed there, and then some of the work that's done is shown in those lower pictures showing the different borehole work, and the lower right picture is a fault trend. It's a geoseismic trench to make sure we really understand a potential faulting area. So those are the different things we do to create the information to feed all those reports.
Steve?
Yeah?
On these last two slides, is there anything that Congress has to do to allow this project to go forward? There's nothing they have to pass or agree to?
Senator Giesel, at this time, there's nothing Congress has to do. They've provided some enabling legislation that may or may not allow the pipeline to enter the park. That was passed, but our design on the pipeline does not enter the park.
Although, you're talking about Denali?
Sorry, Denali National Park.
Okay.
And so our intent is not to enter the park, so we don't view any enabling legislation required at a federal level. But I would also like to say for the record that the delegation, Senator Murkowski, Senator Sullivan, Congressman Young, have just been excellent proponents of the project. And when we meet with all the representatives of all the different agencies in Washington, it's very clear that the delegation has already briefed them on the importance of the project and prepared the way. So we've had really great success there, and I think it's a reflection of all their hard work.
Great. Thank you.
So let me just show you how this summer field work goes. It's a quick video, but this is kind of the backbone of the work we're doing to get all the data we need. So we start with a, let me see if I can get the video to wake up. We start with a briefing, and then we get the crews out into the field, and then they go to work, whether they're doing archaeological work, testing different soils, or in fisheries, capturing fish. This is a streamway, stream team. That's Samantha and Nick. It's a fish shocker. It's a great little tool for fishermen. It stuns the fish. They float up. They capture the fish. They catalog the fish. It's a little grayling. They don't hurt the fish. They catalog the fish, the species, density, all the characteristics of it. They capture all the data around all the different waterways that we have to cross. And the reason we do this is you have to have a very thorough understanding of the environmental, of the environment where we're working, so we can demonstrate we haven't adversely impacted it. These folks are doing archaeological assessments. They walk the entire route of the pipeline. They look at any area where they think there may be some cultural significance. They make sure that there's no cultural heritage artifacts. In the event they find them, they work directly with the State Historical Preservation Office to make sure that the sites are protected and we move the pipeline away. They don't really tell us what they find or where they find it. We just make sure we work together and move away, because it's all done under a protected process with the State Historical Preservation Office. It's another great example of how we have to balance, you know, transparency and confidentiality. The State Historical Preservation Office views this data as very important, and they want it protected with the State Historical Preservation Office. We're not even allowed to see it because we don't want anybody to damage a site. So as these people who are all trained archaeologists, certified archaeologists, find things, they work directly with the State Historical Preservation Office to preserve it. With that said, they have a great job because they get to walk the route every day and make sure we're building the pipe in the right way. The last thing I wanted to show is a community engagement video. Again, I've said we've done 65, 70 of these. We've had them all across the Mat-Su. We've had them all up and down the pipeline right away. We had several in Nikiski. And what we do is we open up some kind of community center. We invite the public to come. A lot of folks come. We've had as many as 250 people attend these. We put up posters. That's Jeff Ron. And all the different people from the project go and talk to people. That's Matt Horniman. He's in charge of land work down there. And just answer questions. And what we find that's kind of gratifying is, even though we've had multiple sessions in some places, we'll have the same people come back and ask more questions and think about it. And it's that community engagement process that can address the kind of questions we're getting here, to make sure that all the stakeholders understand the project and support it. And as we submit these resource reports, we're shifting into a phase where FERC will manage this process and we'll support it, but a lot of the data flows directly to the FERC, so that they make sure that there's no filters on the information. With that said, there's one last thing I wanted to talk about, which is kind of the path to FEEB. If you remember the gated process I showed on the second slide, how do we move from where we are in pre-FEED, spending $25-30 million a month, to FEED, which is a much higher level of commitment? First, we have to finish the FERC process. We need a lot of engagement from the right people. Alaska is an equity participant. We need that owner engagement. We need the folks to step up and as owners with that 25%, feel that sense of ownership, feel that sense of engagement. We've asked businesses to register on the website, aklng-lng.com. We've had about 100 local businesses register. We'll invite those businesses to open houses where we'll talk about different ways to engage them as the project moves forward and learn about their skills to match up global LNG knowledge and local Alaskan knowledge. We have a lot of community meetings, lots more planned, talk with FERC. It's foundational in getting the environmental impact report so that the FERC can document that they've talked to the stakeholders and understand the process. We need help with the legislative engagement to make sure we're really reducing project risk and cost of supply, making sure that the questions you're asking and the different project owner questions get answered. So as you need information, you can provide it either through the company representatives who you know, or any way you'd like to facilitate that. We want to make sure we give you the answers you need to help us move this forward, because the Alaskan legislature has a unique role under SB 138. All that goes together to position us for a decision point in 2016. As I've mentioned a couple times, pre-FEED is just about design, route, site, cost, schedule. Can we be competitive? Can the project be economically viable? We also need to work with the state to identify the offtakes. It's really for the state to say where they are. The project is indifferent. We know we need one to the west of Fairbanks, probably around Minto. We know we need one into the back of the grid in Wasilla to support Anchorage. But there's other points, and we need the state's definition to help us know that as we design the project where do the offtakes go? And we view that as something for the state representatives to help us define. We also need some help on these key commercial agreements. How are we going to work some of the issues that I know you've raised at the onset of this conversation around how do we source gas from the different fields and balance it? What does third-party access look like? What do these other commercial issues look like so that as we move from pre-feed to feed, we have confidence that the commercial issues can be resolved? We also need to take a look at the heads of agreement and SB 138 roadmap around durable, predictable fiscals. It's going to be very important to take that higher level of resource commitment. Folks are going to want to understand, if I put in all that extra resource, is it something that's going to be durable for the long time? The project's going to last for decades. Is there an environment that supports that kind of commitment? And then the last point I make is probably the most important of all, even though it's just six little words on the page. We have to really find ways to keep building alignment between all the parties. Senator Wilikowski asked earlier about these transitions and how they manage. There's going to be a lot of transitions. The question is, can we continue to build on the alignment of the parties such that the folks who have resource ownership of the known resource at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson, the state of Alaska, BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil can find ways to use that shared resource and that shared interest to build an infrastructure that can then access the markets in a competitive, you know, cost-competitive manner. Those were the last couple comments I wanted to make.
Thank you. Questions from committee members? All right, and seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Butt, for your presentation. And as I said earlier, this is just one in a series of reviews we're going to have on this project to fulfill that statutory requirement, and that will be completed over the next 3 weeks. So I think committee members will find it very interesting. So our next meeting will be Monday, February 2nd. It will be a department overview with the Department of Environmental Conservation. So at this time, the meeting will adjourn. The time is 5:16 p.m.